content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we are now been reading from the chapter on senescence. It's for September and October, Work in the Garden. And our topic that we will start with today is how to grow garlic. I grow hardneck garlic because I like the big heads with their extra fat cloves, but also because of what happens around early June when my plants send up their early bonus of tasty flowering stalk or scape. Softneck garlic, the more familiar kind in the grocery store, has a row of largest outer cloves and a row or two of inner smaller ones. It would keep better than what I grow. See storage ideas. We'll get to that next. But oh, those scapes. I prune each mildly garlicky curlicue off, grill it whole, or cut it into pieces and sauté or stir-fry it, or make a batch of scape pesto for the freezer. There are many hardneck types and also many softneck, and selecting a variety that's well-suited to your conditions is where to start. Inquire through an organic garlic specialty catalog for help in making a good match for your soil and season. Like any bulb, garlic prefers well-drained soil, and my raised beds that have been amended for years with compost are ideal. Though it's a tough plant that can adapt to less prime conditions, I think it's worth preparing the soil by adding organic matter and also incorporating a good source of nitrogen, whether composted manure or an organic fertilizer. You only get one chance a year to plant garlic, so do it well. The target time for planting in fall is 3 to 5 weeks before the ground freezes hard, or if you are in a no-freeze zone, around Thanksgiving or early December. Separate the heads into individual cloves, leaving the bulb wrappers intact, and plant each clove 2 to 3 inches deep and spaced about 6 to 8 inches apart in each direction. Watering at planting time is critical to getting root growth started before the ground freezes. Since I am in a cold winter zone, I also mulch the bed with a couple of inches of chopped, rotted leaves, straw, or other mulch. There is not much more to it except patience and regular attention to weeding and watering. Since garlic is in the ground from around November to the next July sometime, I know the garlic is ready when it tells me so, when several of the lower leaves go brown, but 5 or 6 up top are still green. With garlic, unlike its cousin the onion, waiting until all the leaves go brown will promote overripe bulbs whose cloves are starting to separate and the resulting heads won't store as long, since each brown leaf is one fewer potential bulb wrapper. harvesting too soon can also diminish storage life and may limit bulb reaching full size. Harvesting garlic couldn't be easier. However, tempting, don't pull the bulbs out by the above ground stems, or at least without first loosening the soil alongside each row with a spading fork well away from the heads. Another difference between garlic and onion, assuming it's a dry day when harvest comes, onions can be left out to dry right beside the rows that you dug them from. Not so with garlic, which should be moved out of direct sunlight immediately once unearthed. Cure the harvest for several weeks in an airy, warm spot. About 80 degrees Fahrenheit is ideal, out of the sunlight, such as by hanging plants in the back of the garage or spreading them on wire racks there. I have used old window screens stretched between sawhorses, for example. Once cured, the tops are cut off, roots trimmed, and the cured bulbs are stored. Our next topic is storing and preserving garlic. My homegrown garlic crop gets me to almost February, and then it's just not what it used to be. You know how it goes. You've bought late winter cloves that start to sprout and just don't feel as firm or weigh what they did before time took its toll. I don't have a perfect storage spot, which would be 40 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit with 60 to 70% humidity. But with a few tricks, including freezing some as whole, peeled cloves, I do quite well. A barely heated room above my barn, which stays around 40 degrees, is the best I can offer for fresh storage of a portion of the yield. You may have a pantry, closet, or an exterior wall that stays cool. A spot that's too humid, including the refrigerator, may foster mold. Too dry, and the garlic will dehydrate quickly. Don't put all your harvest in one place if you're not sure how it will fare. Experiment with two or three best possible locations. Not all garlic stores equally well. I learned years ago from Ali Swiss, who operates the venerable Northern California organic garlic operation called Fillory Farm. Soft neck varieties, especially artichoke and silver skin types, generally keep longest, often remain firm 10 months after harvest. With hard necks, some store better than others. Porcelains like Romanian red are among the best. Rocamboles have very good flavor, but often dehydrate within a few months. His strategy, grow multiple kinds and eat the shorter storing varieties first. After using some to put up tomato sauce, pestos, and soups for the year, I freeze about half the remaining garlic following safe, sane methods. And no, you cannot just pack it in oil. Even at below 40 degrees, such as in the refrigerator, harmful bacteria may form after about a week, including spores of Clostridium botulinum, the cause of botulism. The low oxygen conditions that bacteria love are ideal, thanks to the oil packing. Oil-packed peeled garlic sold in the market contains a preservative, such as citric acid. Achieving safe preservation this way is best left to commercial packers. Ditto with sun or oven-dried tomatoes. Dry them, pack them, crisp in airtight bags. Then soften a week's worth at a time in oil before using. Herb-infused oils, particularly those with garlic, run the same risk. I freeze some whole peeled cloves by the first method following, and I also offer other tactics gathered from University Extension Services and preserving books. Whole, unpeeled cloves can be frozen as is at harvest time or slightly later, then use as needed. I prefer to separate and peel each clove, toss them very lightly in olive oil, and freeze them in freezer bags or canning jars. I don't thaw the cloves before cooking, but roast or slowly sauté them or drop them into recipes like soups while cooking. Then locate them and mash them against the side of the pot with a fork or back of a spoon once they soften. Some people prefer the convenience of making logs or small bricks of chopped garlic, not unlike my parsley logs, and slicing off just what is needed for a recipe. Likewise, a puree of garlic and olive oil can be frozen like other pestos in cubes or small containers. The University of California at Davie recommends one part garlic to two parts oil for a sauté mixture that remains safely frozen but soft enough to scrape the needed amount off. With all freezer methods, freeze immediately after preparation. Do not refrigerate or store at room temperature, even briefly first. Around January, if I see that I still have a lot of garlic left in storage and worry it won't last, I freeze more. Onions starting to sprout in storage also can be rescued if caught in time and sliced or chopped and frozen in airtight plastic Ziploc bags. And our next topic is a saner fall cleanup. When we say fall garden cleanup, just how clean do we mean? I don't clean up as if I'm vacuuming the living room from one corner to the opposite and hitting every inch in between, but rather selectively, leaving anything that might look good to me or the birds, teasing the place apart gradually. The more I learn about the life cycles of birds, other animals, and especially beneficial insects, and the messier I am getting. If not right in front of the house, then at least in all the less conspicuous spots where a looser style makes for more supportive, high-quality off-season habitat. I have always saved all my leaves, never bagging them, but rather using them as mulch or soil amendment once they are composted. Now I am careful to let any that I can lie where they fell, such as under all the big trees at the garden's periphery. I learned why this matters from experts at the Habitat Network, www.yardmap.org. A joint project of Cornell Lab of Ornithology and the Nature Conservancy. The ecology of leaf litter is surprising. Various Lepidoptera, butterflies and moths, deposit their eggs on leaves of trees of their host species in early fall, presuming that when those leaves drop beneath it, the emerging caterpillars will be near their needed food source. Some butterflies, like the morning cloak and eastern comma, even overwinter as adults in thick layers of leaf litter, and still others remain in their chrysalis or as larvae rolled in a leaf cocoon in a similarly protected spot. Other beneficial insects and spiders overwinter in such places too. All of our leaf blowing and mowing and raking is disastrous to such insect strategies. Leaving faded flowers standing encourages off-season foraging by birds who can feast on seed heads and even on galls of spent goldenrod, which may be filled with protein-rich larvae that can sustain a goldfinch. Nature is intricate, and I love learning what I can do, and just as important, not do, to support it. More ideas. I create a lot of woody debris, and though some must go, I always keep a brush pile, another wildlife supporting mechanism. At the other end of winter, I learned from the Habitat Network to wait until after several 50-degree days to start my spring cleanup. Getting aggressive out there any earlier will destroy nesting sites of bumblebees and other critically important arthropods. I can wait in the name of the greater good. As a gardener, I do make some exceptions to the nature focus, specifically with diseased plants and those with a serious insect infestation or those prone to insect pests like basilicas or to imported cabbage worms. Not basilicas, brassicas, sorry. Good garden sanitation is the fall to remove delicious overwintering places for these non-native pests can help. Hoping to minimize squash bugs, cucumber beetles, those cabbage worms, and more, I don't leave spent, troubled, or vulnerable plants standing. If I had any serious fungal diseases, such as with peonies or roses, I'd clean up extra carefully under those and discard the spore-covered debris, too. And our next topic is Mad Stash. Overwintering tender plants. I am asked two questions over and again by visitors. Where did you get that plant? Referring to whatever looks showiest on the day of their visit, And where do you put all those big pots of tender things in winter? My reply to the second part begins with a question. Are you ready for an adventure? Unless you operate a climate-controlled greenhouse, and even then, if the power fails, matching non-hardy plants to the possibilities of our domestic winter environment, especially in a northern location, is indeed an exploration. I have been experimenting for years with stashing tender plants in the cellar, garage, house, mudroom, wherever I can, to try to turn each purchase into an investment plant. Before I go attempting any real heroics, though, and have to move to a hotel because the house is full, I ask if there is a way to carry over a piece of each instead, as seeds or by taking late summer cuttings of, say, coleus or pelargonium and rooting them, or simply by digging up tubers or bulbs and stashing those, some of the easiest of all, like Canis or Callus. My adventure begins with this kind of thinking about the candidates. Is the plant evergreen or deciduous? The ones with leaves, say rosemary, citrus, or a bay tree, will require light even in winter and can be trickier to accommodate here. The leafless dormant ones, like a fig tree in a big pot, do not. Where did the plant originate? That is, where were its ancestors native? This piece of information will reveal the lowest temperature a plant might withstand, and also whether it might expect a dry, dormant period, a common phase of the life cycle in some zone 8 or 9, or warmer places. Plants willing to rest completely are easier for me to carry over than ones wanting bright light and cool or mild temperatures in my low-light winters and dry, heated home. With those first two considerations, I'm trying to categorize my wish list into rough buckets of winter storage conditions, like cool, bright, or dark, dry, above freezing, or try as a houseplant. Next, I give my home, garage, cellar, and shed the same good hard look. As with the plant analysis, I'm evaluating both off-season temperature range and is it fairly constant or fluctuating, and amount of light, if any. No two cellars or sunrooms or garages are alike. Then I try to make good matchups between plants and places. Sometimes I get it right, but often the first time out, I don't. Typically, I learn something, though, so I can fine-tune my next try, going cooler or warmer or brighter, maybe within the limits of my available spots. And sometimes I surrender, acknowledging I lack a welcoming location for certain things without a greenhouse, or at least without setting up supplemental lighting in one spot that's currently the right temperature but too dark. Whatever I plan to do with a plant, I try to ease the pain of making the transition from outdoors to in. This is important. Don't wait till it's 38 degrees Fahrenheit and damp outside, and the drying heat is blasting 68 degrees Fahrenheit indoors, to do an instant relocation, then expect your houseplants or potted Meyer lemon not to drop its leaves in shock. Anticipate the eventual move in stages over a couple of weeks, perhaps moving them first to a protected porch or garage to dry off before heading inside. Another tip with plants that retain their leaves and want the conditions I have the least the least of, bright and cool, though it will look insane, stage your pots near windows so that the tallest ones are farther from the light than the smaller ones, which would be otherwise be shaded. I know, ugh, but it makes a big difference by efficiently allocating limited light resources. Some plants that I have overwintered for multiple or many years in Zone 5B, bulbs and bulb-like things, easiest of all are the cannas. Dig the tubers, cutting back the frost-blackened foliage, and stash them in the dark, dry cellar or a garage that's frosty and even 45 to 50 degree Fahrenheit. Unpotted is fine. My one and only canna is the giant called the banana canna, Canna musifolia, or grande. Also, easy dark and dry, potted or unpotted, calla lilies, I do likewise with the old-style shiny-leaved green elephant leaves in the genus Alocasia that make a big bulb. The newer, irresistible, matte-leaved Colocasia, like Mojito, Black Magic, or Black Coral, don't bulb up, so they are trickier. Try leaving them potted and actively growing in good light at 60 degrees Fahrenheit at least, or semi-dormant at 45 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit and fairly dry. Light is not critical, therefore. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And we hope you'll join us for the next session when we will continue to read from this book about the garden. Thank you.